Hey everyone, welcome to the Front Judge Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Albino. Now as always, I'm joined by my colleague at Front Judge, Mike Neff, as we'll break down a thrilling Talladega weekend that saw Chevrolet snap its winless streak. And then Corey LaJoy will call into the podcast to break down his career best 11th place finish at Talladega, the new rules package at Super Speedways, and how he was able to get through a lot of the chaos during the race. But before we get started, make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the Front Judge Podcast on iTunes, as those 5-star ratings help us out tremendously. Now let's talk Talladega with Neff. All right, Neff, this could be a fun podcast because last week when we talked about previewing Talladega, we were cautiously optimistic about the race we were going to get. And I got to be honest with you, Neff, I really liked the racing. We were talking off air about, you didn't think it was one of the best plate races in the past 10 years or being the best plate race, which it isn't a plate race anymore. We got to get that out of our mind. Super speedway race in the past 10 years. But I thought it was really, really good.
I mean, I thought it was good. Everybody going crazy about it. It still took a group of cars to have the momentum to be able to launch an attack on the lead. And that was the part that I still kind of wish we could get back to, and again, being nostalgic to being the old get-off-my-lawn guy, back in the even before we had plates, you could have a guy get behind, three or four cars were ahead, a guy could suck in behind him and get a run, pull out, and go all the way past him because he had that much momentum. And it looked like we had that kind of momentum this weekend, but as soon as cars would pull out to pass, it was like they ran into a brick wall. And it's a step in the right direction. I like the fact that we don't have plates now. We got more throttle response. I worry that the odds of us getting the side skirts off of the cars have been dramatically reduced after Kyle Larson got airborne by himself.
Right.
But I felt like it was a good move in the right direction. I would still love to see them go back to the wicker bill going across the middle of the top of the car. I thought that was the best aero package we ever had on these tracks. And unfortunately, we ran it like two or three races, and then Dale Earnhardt died. And it was like we immediately freaked out and took that bill off the car, and we've never put it back. And I really felt like that was the best package we had. And I would like to see that wicker or whatever you want to call it going across the car to the current package just to see what that would do with the racing, because I feel like that might be that one little piece to make it even better. But yeah, it was a good race. I'm not losing my mind over it, but it was a good step in the right direction for our first run without plates.
Yeah, and that's what they called it, right? On Sunday, the wicker bill, the little, it's like a 90-degree angle right above the spoiler.
They put it on the spoiler. Which is the same thing that they put in IndyCar. They do wickers across the trailing edge of the wing. And, when you're doing 200 whatever miles an hour, an eighth of an inch going across there makes a big difference. And so they put that kind of bracket on the spoiler to throw a 90-degree bend and a little bit more resistance on the air coming off the spoiler. The bill I'm talking about basically went right across the middle of the car, mm-hmm. kind of just a little bit in front of the B post, but right across the top of the car, and it was perfectly flat across the top. So at the edges, it was maybe an inch and a half long, and right in the middle of the car, it was maybe half an inch, but it was just a straight thing, but went right across the top of the car, and it really disturbed the airflow that was going right over the top. Punched a lot bigger hole in the air and gave guys some runs from behind.
Right, and yeah, I mean, NASCAR to implement the wicker bill this weekend until the second, final practice on Friday. The first practice, the cars were averaging, I think there's 20 of them or 21 of them over 200 miles per hour. The top, I don't know, dozen or so were over 202. And so NASCAR put that wicker bill on to try and slow speeds down, but it did the opposite. It sped them up. In the final practice, there were six guys over 204 miles per hour. And I got to be honest, fast forward to the race now, those first 10 laps were entertaining as hell, in my opinion. You had guys coming and going. It reminded me, honestly, of like the early 2000s. So, maybe right after Dale Sr. died, like 2002, 2003, where I thought back then, restrictor plate racing, now super speedway racing, I thought that was the best era of it. But that's my opinion. I mean, you could disagree, but you're right when you said, you know, cars, if they got out of line, you know, they went straight to the back, or they still needed a line of cars to propel them front. They need that energy. But you had guys like Eric Jones and Martin Truex go to the back because of penalties or post-race and post-qualifying pre-race penalties, whatever, that they had to, you know, start in the back, all four of the Gibbs cars and both the Roush cars, and they're in the top 10 in, like, I don't know, five laps. So I feel like with last year's restrictor plate package, we wouldn't have had that.
Yeah, I would agree. Last year it would have taken them longer. But again, you still had to have groups of guys to go. Where I would like to see, and you know, I don't have all the answers, but if we could figure out a way to where two or three guys get in a line and they pull out, they can keep moving forward,
right,
and move to the front. And I feel like you get more comers and goers that way. But it was still interesting to watch. I love watching Logano and Keselowski when they get in front,
yep,
doing that dance back and forth in front of the lines and breaking the momentum. I thought there were a couple moves, especially with Logano, that were sketchy. A little abrupt and a little bit dangerous, I thought, in the efforts to slow down those lines. But in the end, that's what it takes to win in modern super speedway racing. You have to be aggressive. You have to go for the smallest of holes. Otherwise, you're going to lose out. And that's why those guys have won the races they have. And it was a bummer that we ended on a caution. I think we were getting ready to have a really cool run from turn three all the way to the finish line. Unfortunately, we didn't get to see that. I'm super glad that everybody after the incident was okay and able to walk away.
Yeah, and usually, you know, we go kind of driver by driver, the running of the, you know, down the rundown of the finishing order. But I feel like this week maybe we should start off with that lap 11 incident. You know, you had Bubba Wallace being pretty aggressive early on. He started in, I think, the mid-20s or something like that. He started 28th. And so he was up in the top five in 10 laps. But on the 11th lap, he made this move on his buddy Ryan Blaney, who he said afterward, that's the last guy he wants to crash, rightfully so, with their, you know, close friendship.
Sure.
But I don't know. What did you think of the move? It was kind of early to being that aggressive, in my opinion, but it's almost like he kind of got pushed, and then he had to make a move, or else he's going to run Blaney over.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I felt like, and I would have loved to have seen an angle right as he made the move to the bottom as to how hard he hit Blaney.
Yeah. Because
from the angle that we had from behind, I mean, Blaney moved pretty dramatically, but Bubba didn't. And that kind of made me feel like he may not have hit him that much. It's just that you're that on the edge right there. But Bubba was trying to make a move because he didn't want to hit him and wanted to take advantage of that huge run he had. And it gives you an idea of just how on the edge these cars really are.
Yeah.
Because even as he hit Blaney and Blaney swerved, Bubba went down, he was still running pretty darn straight and just made that correction so that he didn't hit the apron. And as soon as he did, it like unloaded the right side of the car and just threw him back to the right. And then it was all over after that. And, you know, you hated to see guys like McDowell get caught up in it. I mean, McDowell's just riding around there at the top, way back in the pack, and all of a sudden the car shoots up and drills him in the side. There's nothing he can do about it. That's the vagaries of super speedway racing you hate to see happen.
Yeah, McDowell's had no luck this year. I think that was his fifth finish of 30th or worse, fifth or sixth, and a couple last-place finishes, including this weekend. But, yeah, I mean, I was surprised. You know, Bubba kind of, he wrecked himself trying not to wreck Blaney. And in the process, he took out three or four other cars. I don't know how Blaney hung onto that car. Because the rear end of that car was all sorts of wiggling back and forth.
Blaney had three or four incidents.
Yes.
Same thing with Logano. Yep. Logano had a couple, too, where he was so out of shape. And I mean, I give credit to their abilities. I've seen, you know, and Blaney's not a dirt guy. I know he comes from a dirt family, but he's really not a dirt guy. But to see the saves he makes routinely in cars, you would think he spent his whole life on dirt, because he has cars way out of shape and saves them. And I just, it's a testament to his skill of car control. And again, he's one of those guys, I think, once he really figures this whole thing out, is going to be a winner and a superstar for a long time.
Neff, do you feel bad for Bubba? Not, you know, because he, when we go to these tracks, he's racing for Richard Petty Motorsports, obviously, and he's publicly stated, which I'm kind of surprised he has, that they don't have the money, they don't have the funding and the resources to compete with the top teams. And I feel like lately he's been under a lot of scrutiny. He's only got one top 20 finish this year at Martinsville, which was a 17th. And when you go to a super speedway track, either I mean, he finished second in the Daytona 500 2018. That's their best shot. It is for all small teams. And he's just being, it seemed like a little too aggressive, but do you feel bad for him that he's getting, like, all, like Harvick, even after the wreck, I guess, you know, Bob Pockers tweeted out that he said, you can't push, huh? He went up and told Bubba that. I mean, do you feel bad for Bubba?
Yes and no. I mean, I feel like he's in a difficult situation because he's driving for a team that likes to scream poor, but when you talk to some of the other teams that are back there racing in the same group, and we always talk about how there's three distinct groups in the races. There's the guys up front that can win. There's the guys in the middle that could win if everything lines up right, but they're really kind of racing for mid-pack. And then there's guys at the race at the back. And in reality, the Richard Petty budget should have them in that middle pack, but their performance tends to be more towards that backpack, and they're kind of right at that line. And you talk to a bunch of these teams that are in the backpack that would love to have the money that they think Richard Petty has. I don't know if RPM really has that money or not. Nobody really knows what teams have. But he's running for a team that historically has a huge place in the sport and now is not. And so he's carrying on that legacy. He's also saddled with the diversity side of things, mm-hmm. because as much as it drives me crazy that NASCAR likes to push that agenda, when in reality, if we're trying to push diversity, we shouldn't talk about it at all and just let it kind of happen organically, so that it's not like beating you in the face. You're like, hey, that's Bubba. That was one of the weird things when he won at Martinsville a few years back. The last thing in my mind was that he was a black race car driver. I just thought he was Bubba. He's my friend Bubba, and I was so happy for him. But we hear this agenda. So he is, whether he wants to be or not, is at the forefront of that. He embraces that and embodies it, absolutely. I think he's torn in a few different directions, and I feel like he's really on a razor's edge of a balancing act. And for what he has to work with and the pressures that are on him, I think he does a great job. And I honestly think if the situation changed a little bit to whether he ended up at a different team or the Petty organization got a little bit better with the cars or with just their whole package, I feel like he could be a winner in the sport. I mean, he's proven that he can win at the other levels. So there's no reason he can't at the cup level. That win he had at Michigan in the truck a couple of years ago was in, I mean, that was in a back marker truck for all intents and purposes. And he got out there and won in the thing. So he's got talent. He has an amazing personality. He is such a fun person to be around. And I agree. He's in an almost untenable situation. But for what he's got and what he faces, I think he does a pretty darn good job.
Yeah, you said that pretty well. I look at RPM as a whole right now. I mean, they're only 4 points ahead of Go Fast Racing. And you would think that they're, you know, him and Corey LaJoy are obviously really close friends, but you would think, just comparing those two budgets, that they'd be well ahead of GoFast, at least from what we think we know, right? Like you were saying. But I know Bubba pissed a lot of drivers off on Sunday. I know I listened to the Door Bumper Clear podcast with Brett Griffin and TJ Majors last night, Monday night. And I guess Clint Bowyer went on the tirade of all tirades the other night, other day at Talladega. Brett Griffin said he never heard anything, you know, he's been Clint's spotter for a while now, and he said he's never heard Clint go off like that before. So, that you piss Clint off when he goes off like that. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. RPM's in a, I feel like in a difficult situation right now, and they just really can't get out of their own way. I mean, it's not only, I can't remember the stat off the top of my head right now, but not only was it been like the first 9 out of 10 races this year where he hasn't finished in the top 20, but it was most of the second half of last year too. It's almost like they're getting worse instead of better. And you know, Bubba's been with the team for a year and a half, not almost a year and a half. If you include 2017, pretty much a year and a half, because he ran, what, 4 or 5 races with him in, throughout Almirola's injury. So, I don't know enough. But after that first incident, which, you know, was lap 11, the race was kind of clean. It was really entertaining, in my opinion, but it was pretty clean. There's a caution on lap 130. That was the next caution for an incident, which was just debris. So then you go all the way down to like 5 to go, and you have another big crash with, you know, Buescher and Almirola turning Buescher. And Matt, that was a big crash. Matt DiBenedetto getting into it, and Buescher going up in the air. That's just a racing deal, right, at Talladega?
Yeah, I don't think there was anything you could do about that. It was, you're getting down in laps, and people are trying to make moves. And it just was one of those things where the one car gets a little out of shape, gets into another one, and the next thing you know, cars are spinning. And yeah, as much as those cars are on edge, it was just a racing deal.
Got it. And I agree with that. So that set up a restart with, I believe, 4 laps to go. And then all hell kind of broke loose enough, especially coming, you know, Eric Jones spun out with 3 to go. But then coming with the white flags where it really got chaotic. You had Ricky Stenhouse Jr. blow a tire, he said, over the radio. And he crashed in the coming out of the tri-over, going across the start finish line. And I'm happy NASCAR didn't throw the caution there, but I think they were going to, they had to throw the caution at some point, because his car came to a stop, and you know, had the drive. There's a lot of crashes at these speedway tracks coming to the finish line, and so with his car right in the vicinity, obviously they had no choice to throw a caution at some point. However, there was another crash on the final lap, a pretty big one. You had David Ragan and William Byron get together, hit Kyle Larson, and this is what you were alluding to earlier. It looked like Larson's car kind of just flipped by itself, right?
Yeah, it did. That's the part that I think has got NASCAR really on edge, is Larson's headed to the inside wall with Jeffrey Earnhardt, but they're separated from each other. It's not like Jeffrey was pushing on the side of Kyle's car. The roof flap on the passenger side of the car does deploy, so it's breaking up airflow over the top of the car, and yet his car still lifted off the ground all by itself. And I would not be surprised if they look into it and figure out that wicker bill on the spoiler might have contributed a little bit to that, simply because of the angle that it's at and the air coming across from the side probably provided a little lift from that being on there, and they'll probably end up making another tweak when we go back to Daytona. But that's the concerning part, and that's the part that always spins out NASCAR, is their worry about these cars getting airborne by themselves. It's one thing when we see these cars get airborne because another car gets into their side or whatever. That's going to happen. We see that happen in truck races when they're running 140. I mean, that's just going to happen. But when we've got these cars going this fast, you know, 204, 205, whatever they were running there near the end, and a car gets sideways and it gets airborne all by itself, that's the part that freaks them out, because they worry that if that happens on the front straight, we get something like Bobby Allison did back in 87, and that we can't have. And so that's where you're no doubt going to get cars in wind tunnels over the next few weeks that are sitting sideways with air blowing over them with that wicker bill on it to try to figure out where that lift is coming from. And if we have to change the angle of the roof flaps, if we have to add more roof flaps, whatever we're going to do to make sure when they turn sideways, we get enough of the air disturbed that it keeps them sitting on the ground.
Yeah, and TV will never do it justice ever for a car hitting a wall at, you know, close to speeds of 200 miles per hour. He's probably, I don't know how fast he was when he was hit the wall, but you'd think he slowed down a little bit because he was going to hit the wall regardless, and you could hear him. Yep. There's video of fans on the backstretch. You could hear them obviously slam on the brakes, but when the car took off, when it started getting in the air, it sounded like a plane took off almost. So, that was a really scary incident.
I think the only one I've ever seen that truly gave you a feeling of how hard a car hit a wall was when Elliott Sadler hit the inside wall on a backstretch at Pocono a few years back. And Elliott got out of the car and said that was the hardest hit he'd ever taken. But they had like a still camera shooting down the wall, and you just saw the flash of the car come in and just compress, and the dirt behind the wall shot up in the air. But he was like in and out of the frame so fast, you realize just how hard that car hit that wall. And that gives you some feeling of it. But yeah, usually on TV, it's almost like a ballet, and they look like they're just kind of grazing into the thing. When you're doing 200 miles an hour, I don't care if you got a safer barrier or not, you're taking a load.
Yeah, I was surprised that Fox didn't have a clear-cut angle of the incident. You know, they cut away to it live, and I think at that point, I expected the caution to come out. And I knew it had to come out because Stenhouse was just sitting at the finish line. So it had to come out at some point. It was ironic on Monday was Steve O'Donnell, or maybe it was even Sunday after the race, Steve O'Donnell posted a picture saying that the caution flew for Stenhouse, but it was a half a lap later. So I thought they maybe get him to turn. But the crazy thing is that they threw the caution, if it was for Stenhouse, they threw it as the second wreck was transpiring. So I don't know. I think that's kind of an excuse.
I'm pretty sure that pure speculation, I've got no knowledge. My guess is they would have thrown it somewhere near the end of pit lane or the middle of the trioval, and that would have given the drivers a chance to be off the gas enough that they're not going to wreck when they get down to where Stenhouse was. But, yeah, they didn't throw that caution until the second incident. I mean, Larson, I think, had already impacted the inside wall by the time that caution came out. I would be stunned if that was truly for Stenhouse.
Yeah.
The timing would just be way too coincidental.
Yeah, ironic. I would say I don't think they would have gotten all the way to the trioval. I would have set off turn four only because there's a big piece of debris. And from the spot, I was hearing the spotter say that there's debris all over the front stretch because he hit right before the finish line.
Yeah.
So there's no way they're getting back to, the checkered flag. Those were some, it was a fairly clean race. Honestly, there's three big crashes, which we never like to see. But also, Jeff Earnhardt took a really hard hit to that inside wall.
Yep.
That was kind of scary as well. Not only with Larson flipping, but with Jeff Earnhardt hitting that wall head on. Now, we're a long ways in this podcast now, Neff, and we haven't even mentioned the winner, Chase Elliott. Nor have we mentioned Chevrolet's dominance. I wasn't surprised that Elliott won. He's a good plate racer. Always has been, really, since he came to NASCAR. Hasn't always had the finishes, but I was surprised at how dedicated Chevrolet was to each other, although I guess they had a meeting at 9:30 in the morning on Sunday, and they had meetings leading up to the race, too, of saying, like, you're going to push each other to this win, and that's what happened.
Yeah, it sounds like the suits from Detroit came down and had a little come to Jesus and said, look, we're paying a heck of a lot of money to have these bow ties on these cars, and y'all are getting your butts kicked because you're not working together. So it's interesting. It's, we've seen it we saw it a big time last year with Ford working together, especially when the Stuart Haas organization got out front last year. But we've seen some Toyota work with it too at the Daytona 500. And yeah, there was talk of it, but even on Sunday, you know, it wasn't Chevy out front the whole time. No. There was a few stretches there where there was a whole bunch of Fords and not a lot of Chevys out front. And I think it was just one of those deals that at the end, the way it worked out was everybody that was Chevy related was right there together at the front, and that just happened to play out that way. You can lay the greatest plans in the world, but in the end, when you got three or four laps to go, you're racing with whoever you got around you. You can't be worrying about badging at that point. I think it just worked out that way. But I want to talk about our new king of super speedway racing, freaking Ryan Preece. Modified boy is coming out swinging on these plate tracks or super speedways. I don't know what it is, but he is really good at avoiding wrecks just in general. And I think that ability that he has developed, however he's got it together, really benefits him on these super speedways. And I will not be surprised at all to see him win at Daytona when we get down there in July.
Yeah, I just looked at the stats from Sunday, and Chevrolet only led 74 of the 188 laps, but they won all three stages with Ty Dillon, another impressive run.
How about that?
Yeah, another stage win. That's the second of the year. And then Chase Elliott won in stages 2 and 3. Preece, yes, he had a great showing, best career finish in third. But, I mean, I look at JTG Doherty Racing as a whole. They, and I even tweeted this out on Sunday during the race, they always lag back at these plate. So hard to, you know, get super speedway and plate straight. But these speedway races, and then they find themselves in the top 10. And that's where Buescher was right around when he got wrecked with a few laps to go. And Preece was right up there too, obviously, because he finished third. So, I mean, it seems that even with AJ Allmendinger the past couple of years, I mean, he finished, what, third in the Daytona 500, I think, 2 years ago? And then they both had top fives last year in the July Daytona race. They're good. They're a good plate team or super speedway team. So, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if he, I guess, won a Daytona either in July. And then you look at, you know, Chase Elliott, obviously, it was a much needed win for Chevrolet across the board. They went the first nine races only having, I think, five top fives, you know, throughout the whole manufacturer. And on Sunday alone, they had four.
Yeah, and we got to give a shout-out to our boy Shu, too.
Oh, yeah.
Corey LaJoy coming in 11th. He was up on a wheel there at the end. Somebody posted a picture on Facebook today of him five wide coming through the tri-oval as they were coming to take the white. But, that's the cool thing about super speedway racing. It's the cool thing about this new package. I realize I'm not the biggest fan of it just because the cars are so, I don't want to say easy to drive, because we saw that with Bubba and Blaney together. But at the same time, it's really hard to spin these cars out, especially when we're on intermediate tracks. And I would like to see them be more difficult to drive. But with the package we've got, you have got anybody, any given Sunday can be anybody's race. And it's cool to see these back marker teams get a shot every now and then when things line up where they get a good finish. And it's great for the sport. It's great for their fans. It's great for their sponsors. And I just think it's good for the sport in general.
Yeah, I think Larry McReynolds had this stat on the broadcast where he said that there'd only been 18 cautions in the final stage this year between the nine races leading up to Talladega. And obviously, you know, the final stage is like half the race at least in most of these tracks.
Just about, yep.
So this weekend had three. And yeah, I mean, you mentioned LaJoy, which he's our guest this week, so we'll talk about him a little later on. But Brendan Gaughan, man, whenever this dude and whenever Beard Motorsports show up to the track, which is always at the super speeder races, they're a factor. I mean, they're running with ECR motors, so they're going to be quick. But Brendan's he's always has been, in my opinion, an underrated speedway driver.
Yeah, Gaughan has always been a good plate racer and a good super speedway racer. And he's got that right temperament that it takes to be good in these races and to be there at the end. And that team, You know, they spend a lot of time massaging on cars to make sure they're good when they need to be at these races. And they got a guy behind the wheel that can show up four times a year and really get it done. And, I mean, the dude is a walking quote factory, so he's great to have. We love having him at the track because he tells some great stories and has great quotes. But they put on a show. And it's, if there's ever going to be a part-time team that wins in modern NASCAR, that is the team that I think will do it, because there ain't a lot of part-time teams that they get that far forward in these races, and those guys are always coming towards the front at the end.
Yeah, I mean, that's his second top 10 with this team. The other, I think, was in Daytona in 2017. Always a factor, though, and it's usually just like JTG. He always comes on late in the going, stays out in the back, because at one time, like, they're a one-car operation, but literally a one-car operation. Now they got two. So, stepping up for Beard Motorsports, and I mean, they'll be at Daytona, and I wouldn't be surprised if they got another top 10. Hell, maybe even a top 5, honestly. But I want to go back to this manufactured thing, Neff, because for years, right? So in 2016 Daytona 500, that's really when this all started, when Toyota dominated the race. You had Hamlin, Kyle Busch, Carl Edwards, Martin Truex in the 78, and Matt Kenseth, really not leaving each other outside of Carl Edwards spun early on, and he had to come back, but he ended up getting a top five finish. Hamlin won the race. I mean, it was kind of all bets off on the last lap, which is what Hamlin did. He came from fourth to first in the final lap and kind of moved Kenseth out of the way, right? So That's where this all started. And then Ford really took ship. They won the next seven restrictor plate races at Talladega and Daytona. And I feel like Ford's really been the template of what these manufacturers wanted to get at these tracks. Chevrolet's always had, maybe it's because there's two different engine suppliers with Hendrick and ECR. I think that's probably a big factor. But even in like the Daytona 500 this year, you had Toyota guys and Chevy working together, which we never saw, like Gibbs and Hendrick. You don't see that. And so I think you're right when you say like the guys from Detroit had to come down and say something.
Yeah, and in hindsight, I saw even a tweet about it from somebody that the ECR teams try to work together all the time, and it seemed like the Hendrick contingent kind of did their own thing and really doesn't work and play well with others. And hey, when you're the big dog and the best in the deal, you can do that. But I think at this point we're looking at Hendrick is not the big dog right now, and it has taken this change of fortune to kind of get them to realize maybe working with the other Chevy teams to get the Camaro right and get it back to the front and, you know, regain the manufacturer lead is important. And I believe this weekend especially is going to kind of nudge them along in that. I think we may see some more Chevy cooperation going forward across all Chevy teams rather than the two camps of the Hendrick power plant and the ECR power plant.
But in your opinion, does this really mean anything going forward? Like, does this give Chevrolet momentum? I think it might give Chase Elliott momentum and maybe even like Alex Bowman, because he needed a good finish. That was his first top 10 of the year. But like with Elliott, right? We're going to Dover this weekend, which he won at in October. But this year, I mean, that was just his third top 10 of the year.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good deal just for Chevy in general to be like, hey, we won a race. You know, we have been thrashing with this Camaro, and I think most everybody thought once 2018 was in the rearview mirror, they were going to come out in 2019 and be, you know, super competitive with everybody else, and they've just been out to lunch still. And I think they've all realized that they've got the most cars in the field and they are not getting the value out of it. It is time to all work together so that we can all pull the rope in the same direction and get back to the front in Chevys. And then if we want to fragment back off again, we can do that. But for now, Chevrolet is putting whatever money they're putting into this thing. They want a better return on investment than they're getting. And I think that's why you saw that meeting go on and why you ended up seeing them all cooperate together.
Yeah, and with Elliott, I mean, you got to think he wants some help with Chevrolet, right? Because since the Daytona 500 in 2018, when Austin Dillon won in the Camaro's first race in the cup level, there's been four Chevrolet wins, and they've all come from the 9 car. And at four different tracks, too. So Chase is showing that he's got a range of variety of tracks that he can do well at and win at, which is good because for the first, 2.5 years of his career, he really didn't show that.
Yep, 8 second place finishes without a win.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think this is what Chevy obviously needed this. I mean, I can't remember the last time. I think I heard a stat where it was 92. I could be way off on that. When they went 9 races or more into a season without winning, so they definitely needed that. And Elliott's locked into the playoffs, but then you look at his teammate like Jimmy Johnson right now. He's on the bubble because he had a flat tire early on in the race, and he ended up finishing 10 laps down in 33rd.
Yeah, I'm going to actually touch on that this week in my Friday column. There's a handful of rules that I'm not sure fans understand. And with the plethora of wins that we've got for Kyle and Penske and Denny, odds are anybody wins is locked in this year. It's going to take a real cataclysmic change for that to not happen. But I saw a whole lot of discussion on social media this weekend when Chase won because somebody threw out the possibility that it wasn't necessarily locked in. And the amount of people that did not understand that if there's more than 16 winners, somebody with a win would not make the playoffs was astounding to me. And so in my column this week, I'm going to go through and kind of point out there's a handful of rules that I think people don't understand, and we're going to take a look at a few of them and look at it. But yeah, odds are he's locked in. There's a minuscule possibility. I mean, we got 16 races left, and so
you need 11 winners.
Theoretically, you could have it happen that you had 11 different new winners, but the odds of that are pretty small. Although I had, in one of my responses, I had somebody said, I'm waiting for the list of 16 guys that could win races, or 17 total guys that could win races. And I went through and listed off 17 total people that have won races in the last, 3 years. So, I mean, it's not out of the realm at all. And then you have people like Hemric and Priest that could easily come up and take a win, or DiBenedetto for that matter, that is in equipment that's capable of winning. And if the things line up right, they could easily shock the world and win as well. So it's a possibility. This year, I don't know that it's a very good possibility.
No.
But one of these years, I am confident we're going to have a year where we get 17 winners in a regular season, and then it's going to be fun to see the narrative that comes out from the broadcast partners, because they always tout that win and you're in philosophy, and it's not true. And one of these days, it's going to bite them.
It could. It won't be this year. I think there will be 11 or 12 at the most this year. Because Gibbs and Penske, I mean, they won the first 9 together in between 5 drivers. So, but one of those drivers, because I do want to hit on this, right? Because I said Jimmy Johnson's on the bubble right now. But then you look at the drivers outside the bubble, and it's actually, I mean, there's a pretty good list. You got Paul Menard just outside, and he drives for the Wood Brothers, but that's Penske equipment. And then you got Eric Jones, 8 points behind Johnson for that spot. And then you got William Byron, Stenhouse, and Larson. Now, Larson just can't seem to get out of, they just keep getting their own way. If he's going to turn around, though, I think it'll be this weekend at Dover, because he's ran very well there in the past. I actually picked him to win the fall race last year, and he was just off. So, I mean, maybe he doesn't turn it around. But if he doesn't turn it around, granted, he's only 17 points out right now. Like, it's really tight there between 15th and 22nd. You're talking about only, not many points. You're talking about 30 something points.
Yeah, the battle's going to be really cool when we get down to the end of regular season, assuming things stay relatively status quo between now and then. You're going to have an instance over the last couple of races where stage points are going to get real important.
Yes.
And guys are going to be making some strategy calls, and you're going to see some people make some desperation moves because they have to. And that's going to make things pretty fun when we get down to the end of the regular season.
So I know we talked last week, you know, in our kind of quarterly review of the year so far, that we both think Larson will make the playoffs. Now, it was Talladega, and yes, he ended up upside down, and you can't really control it. You know, Talladega's not a place where you can control your own destiny, like a Dover or other tracks. So, I expect him to run well this weekend, but if he doesn't, what's that say, Neff? Because he's got five straight finishes of 18th or worse.
I mean, it's... again, it's been... I would feel different if it was them shooting themselves in the foot all the time. There's been a couple things, like at Richmond. I mean, you had a tire rub and didn't get it properly cleared, and that ended up costing you the whole night. So I kind of put that one on him a little bit. But a bunch of these bad finishes have been because he's been caught up in somebody else's mess. And so it depends on why they don't have a good run, if they don't have a good run. But if they... at some point, you chalk it up to a bad year and you move on to next year, or you try to make changes. And I don't know which way they'll end up attacking it. I mean, I was watching the Dale Jr. Download with Kirk Shelmerdine from a couple weeks ago, and they talked about 92. And if you look back at the career of Dale Earnhardt from... you know, mid-80s on, 1992 is just an abomination. I mean, they were just so god-awful that year, and they're coming off a championship. They won the championship the next year. You're like, how did this happen in this one year where they won one race, they couldn't get out of their own way, they finished like 12th in points? I mean, it just, sometimes it just happens that you get that year where you just throw it all away and there's nothing you can do about it. It may be that year for Larson. I still feel like they've just had a really bad run, and they have one or two good runs, kind of shake the dust off, grab a win at Michigan because we know he wins at 2 mile tracks, and go on from there. So I'm not writing them off yet. If they have a bad weekend at Dover, provided it's because of somebody else, I won't write it off. If they have another weekend where they have uncontrolled tire, pit road speeding, stuff like that happening, then is when you really got to worry about the organization of that team. Because if they're shooting themselves in the foot, then it's a different problem. So far this year, the majority of what's happened to them has been out of their control, so that's just a matter of... It may just be one of those years where luck's not on your side, and you hope it turns around before the end of the regular season.
You got any more to talk about the Cup race? You want to move to Xfinity? Because I thought that was also a very entertaining race.
I give a shout out to the fans in Talladega.
Very good crowd.
I mean, we came off of Bristol a few weeks ago that was really not good fan attendance wise, and you know, people talk about, oh, it's out in the middle of nowhere, there's not a lot of places to stay and all kinds of stuff. There's no hotels around Birmingham, around Bristol, or around Talladega. I mean, people are staying in Atlanta or Birmingham and driving and or camping. And that place was packed out. And they put on a show. They're doing the infield renovation stuff. I'm glad to see it. I love that they support the sport so well. And, yeah, I just want to give a thumbs up to the Talladega crowd. Oh, and a Red Farmer. Red Farmer. A buddy of mine was over at the short track watching Redneck Jesus running all weekend. And Red Farmer was over as well, made the A-main in his division. And he's 89 years old, 90 years old, something like that. Still out there wheeling it on a dirt track. It's just, that dude is amazing, and we got to give him a thumbs up.
Yeah, that was a good feature they had on Fox on Sunday. All right, so with the Xfinity Series, Neff, Tyler Reddick finally gets a win. He's led a ton of laps this year, finished second, I think, three times, has now seven top fives. That's as many as he had all of last year. when he won the championship. It was about time. You know, he was going to win in a matter of time. It just, I guess it's not a surprise it happened at Talladega because he's a good plate driver. But with the way it happened, because, he won the first stage. Him and Ross Chastain led all 25 laps. But then in the second, there was a weird instance at the end of the first stage where Ross Chastain was bumping down the pit road and they both got caught for speeding. And it was, I think, the first time I've ever saw where the driver getting bumped down pit road was caught. And, it's not really a fault of his own. It's because he was getting pushed.
Right.
Which that was kind of crazy. So they both got penalized. Then he hit the wall and then he got a tire penalty for bringing the jack out of the pit box. So, I mean, he overcame a lot of adversity. He got to the front late and then just held on. He was making some incredible blocks. We talk about blocking.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Like, top, bottom, middle, it didn't matter. And they were very, abrupt. The last lap was very entertaining. I got to be honest with you enough. I thought Greg Golding was going to win the race for Bobby Dotter.
He had a shot. There's no doubt about that. It's, I'm proud. I'm happy for my buddy Randy. For those of you that have paid attention on these podcasts over time, you've probably heard me talk about the fact that I used to work on Randy Burnett's late model back when he was a racer.
Reddick's crew chief.
And now he's Reddick's crew chief. And we can still give him grief. His nickname when we were racing was P2 because he always finished second. And so he's trying to say that we can't call him that anymore. I told him he's still got to win a couple more races before he officially shakes that moniker. But yeah, it was an entertaining race, like you said, and I'm with you. I thought Golding had a real shot. I wasn't sure we were going to make it back around at the end, but it's cool to see cars coming across and winning races with Bear Bond on them on super speedways.
Yeah, cool diecast.
Because Chase Elliott, same thing. He had damage on the left front on his car that had Bear Bond on it.
True.
And so you end up having these winners' cars with Bear Bond on them. It was pretty cool. It lets you know that aero's not truly that important. I mean, it's still way important, but it's not. It doesn't kill you if you have a little bit of aero issues. But I was happy for Reddick. It's funny, they've kind of had to manufacture a little bit of a chip on their shoulder this year, but when NASCAR put out the initial commercials or whatever for the Xfinity series, they did not include Reddick in the...
Yeah, the defending champion.
And he's the defending champ, and he's, he switched teams or whatever, but he's still running full-time in your division. And so I think that little kind of slap in the face has really been under Reddick's skin this year. And I think he's on a mission to prove that he belongs and to prove that he's the champion. And they've had speed, and he put it up front, and he stayed up front at the end when the money was on the line. So we give him credit for that, and we'll see what happens when we roll into Dover and if he can ride this momentum to two wins in a row.
Wouldn't be surprised. That whole organization's really kind of turned it around from last year because, I mean, for so long, they went over 2 years without winning until Austin Dillon, we're talking about Richard Childress Racing, obviously, until Austin Dillon won a rain-shortened race last year at Michigan. Hemric was so close for that team so many times, as I couldn't even count how many top fives, but really top two and top threes in races that he's let, slip away at the end. So I think it's crucial that they got an Xfinity regular back in victory lane for that team. I wasn't sold on Reddick for a while, I'll be honest. He's always run well in everything he's been in, whether it's been Brad Keselowski in the trucks, even Ganassi in Xfinity. Obviously won the championship last year with Junior Motorsports. But I think, and I don't think it's just me. I think this is just I think a lot of people think this. The way that they won the champ, like, he wasn't the best car last year. He wasn't the best driver last year. You had Bell and Allgaier, really a two-headed monster for much of the year, winning a combined, I think, 12 races. And then Reddick just, I think he was maybe the best in the playoffs, most consistent for sure. And then, he got the high line rolling at Homestead and won the race. And then, was granted the championship because of that. I'm sold on Reddick now. Just with how he started at RCR, who I feel like, for years now has been a step off of Junior Motorsports, who I think's the top Chevy team. in the Xfinity series. But then you look at him competing against the likes of Cole Custer, who's won twice this year, and Christopher Bell, obviously. And he's ahead of them in points. He's more consistent this year. I think Reddick's the real deal. And you know, I know he started the Daytona 500, and I don't know where he finished off the top of my head, but I truly think he's Cup ready. I mean, if you compare him to other Xfinity drivers who are in the Cups, former Xfinity drivers who are in the Cup Series now, like Hemric, I think he's more Cup ready than Hemric.
Yeah, the argument's always been on Hemric that he didn't win at the other national levels.
Yeah.
Which is a valid argument, I mean, because he didn't. But it just kind of lined up that was the way it fell for him. I've been a Reddick fan. Again, I'm a dirt track guy. I'm a Mini Outlaw guy. He came up through Mini Outlaw sprint carts. I've been a fan since he flipped out of the park at Millbridge and ended up hanging upside down in a tree. And literally was like 4 or 5 feet off the ground. I didn't realize it. Popped his belts and fell out of the cart. They literally lifted the cart out of the tree, replaced a front spindle, and he came back and won the feature.
That's badass.
I mean, it was awesome. And so I've been a fan since then. I love that he's just a down-to-earth regular dude. He doesn't have any pretenses, and he just loves to race. And he wants to win in anything he gets in, and he hates losing. And he may not have quite the histrionics that some of the other guys do when they don't win, but it eats at him. And he is always out to prove. And again, I know we give a lot of these guys grief that are height challenged. He and Allgaier and some and Allmendinger and some guys like that. But I you know, and whether it's true or not, I think that's part of their outlook on life, you know, because when you grow up as a short person, you catch grief from a lot of people. And I think it just helps toughen you up, and I think it helps give you an attitude where you want to prove people wrong. And I think that plays into it with Reddick, but he's, as you said, he's won in everything he's gotten in. I think he's Cup ready, but I honestly think it would be cool to see him pull off back-to-back wins in the series switching teams, because I think that would be a really impressive feat before he finds his way on to the next level.
Yeah, that would be cool. I think a lot of drivers on the hot seat, but if you look at RCR, like, he came over to RCR because he felt like that was the better opportunity to get to the Cup level compared to, you know, staying in JRM and going to Hendrick, because they have a whole bunch of young guys. So I don't see Austin Dillon get out of that three car anytime soon. Maybe they'll have to go back to three cars. I mean, I think that would probably be the best option, because Hemric, I mean, yes, he's had a terrible year so far. A lot of it just bad luck. But I don't feel like you can quit on him after 1 year after moving him up. And he's got all these partners behind him. And I think Hemric's a great, you know, a great driver. He just hasn't pulled through and won yet. But you look at, like, the Xfinity Series as a whole this past weekend, Neff, you had the who's who up front for a lot of the race, too. It wasn't just like, you know, Gaulding finished second by luck. He ran in the top five for a lot of that race. So kudos to the 08 team and Bobby Dotter. They prepared, obviously, a really good car. Then you had guys like Josh Williams in the top 10 the entire race. Finished eighth. Chris Cockrum in 10th. David Starr in the top 15. I mean, these are the... Obviously, Talladega brings out the small teams, and they're going to run... You know, they have a chance to run well, like we said earlier on with the Cup teams. But they lived up to that on Saturday.
Yeah, absolutely. It was one of those deals where plate races give everybody a shot, and they definitely all had a shot. And like I said, I thought it was cool that we had a winner with Bear Bond, and in all honesty, it looked like they had like packing shipping tape on that car. I meant to give Randy
different colors.
Yeah, because it was like
brown.
It's Bear Bond, so we went over to the UPS store and grabbed packing tape or something. But yeah, it's again, it's a cool deal. As you said, RCR at the Cup and Xfinity level this year has had a lot of speed, and that is something that they really didn't have last year. They raced well, but they didn't have speed. This year they've got speed. They're working a little more on the racing well side of it. And if they're able to start putting the races together on a cup side, I think you could see them be dominant in both series.
Yeah. Any final thoughts before we kind of move on to Dover?
Nah, I think we're good.
Got it. Well, Neff, we got a triple header this weekend in Dover. Yeah. First time the trucks have been on track in, what, a month? Over a month.
6 months, something like that.
Yeah, close enough. So I expect a good weekend of racing, you know, in Dover. Who do you got winning the three races?
Oh, you're going to make me make picks already. Goodness gracious. Trucks, now that they're back on track after months.
I'm going to go Brett Moffitt. I think Moffitt needs a win. I mean, he won the championship last year. He won, what, six races, made the switch to what you would think would better his career. But so far, I mean, it's been the Kyle Busch show. Kyle Busch isn't racing this weekend. So there's going to be a new winner, you'd think, unless Austin Hill goes back to victory lane.
You would hope. I'm going to be a wussy and go with Johnny Sauter. Just because I'm pathetic that way, taking the easy route out. Although I think our boy Harrison Burton's going to give him a run, but I think Johnny Sauter's going to be your winner. Xfinity side, I'm going Christopher Bell. I know, again, cheap way out, but at Dover, it's just that's his track. I mean, it's just it suits his style.
Yep.
And I picture him running away with it. The one that I'm going to jump on that's going to shock the world, I'm jumping on the 48 for the cup win.
Oh, boy.
Jimmy Johnson owns Dover, has had victories there many times when they have had struggles or they've needed something. And I feel like they had a decent car in Talladega until he lost talent. So I think that this is the time, riding the momentum, Chevy's all on board, everybody's all pumped up, that I think you're going to see Jimmy Johnson come back to victory lane at Dover.
That's a good pick. I mean, I think Johnson needs a kind of redemption from Dover because if you remember in the fall, he didn't even get to start the race. He was in the garage before the green flag started. So, yeah, he needs something, and this season obviously hasn't gone as planned either. But for I said Mava for trucks. Xfinity, I'm going to go Allgaier. We talked about the two-headed monster earlier from last year. And they both won at this track last year. So I think Allgaier finally gets back to victory lane this year and kind of puts a rough start to the year aside.
Yeah, I say, speaking of somebody that's had some bad luck.
Yeah.
Man.
Luckily, you know, he's got a lot of stage points and whatever, so he's sixth in points or something. But I think he goes back to victory lane. And then in Cup, I'm going to go Joey Logano. And I'm going to go Logano because he's never won at Dover at the Cup level, yet he says it's his favorite track. So he's always ran well there, just hasn't gotten a victory yet. But I think that'll probably change this weekend. But I wouldn't be surprised if you saw like a Chase Elliott. I mean, you know, we talked about Chevrolet hitting on something. This is probably, arguably, Chase's best track. He's, you know, he gave away the fall Dover race 2 years ago in 2017 on the final lap to Kyle Busch and then redeemed himself last year. I think he's got a second place and a third place finisher. Always runs well at Dover, so wouldn't be surprised if we saw the 9 get back to victory lane.
Yeah, no, that would be a cool story too, going back to back after Chevy struggles. I think any Chevy winning this weekend again is going to be an interesting story because I think everybody is discounting the fact that it was a super speedway race at Talladega and they're not giving them full credit yet for being back and being competitive. So that would be a cool story.
And also, I think Logano's going to win because he feels like he's given away the last four races. After Richmond, he said he felt like he's given away three in a row, and I thought at Talladega he had the best car. He led 37 laps, and like we said earlier, you know, he was blocking top to bottom over and over. So he's given away, he feels it's four races in a row. So, I mean, he's going to be determined.
Truth.
All right, Neff. We got Corey LaJoie coming up. Like we said earlier, solid 11th place finish, tied a career high. We're big on the LaJoie, you know, bandwagon. He's always been great to the podcast. really good run for him at Talladega, and I think much needed because, you know, going to GoFast is definitely a step up from over the past couple of years, what he's been in, whether TriStar, BK, or whatever. But we know this kid can race.
He's made some mistakes at Dover in the past, and he'll even admit that he went out. I mean, I remember him telling me the story that he went out one time and tried to follow Jeff Gordon just to learn. And he's like, you know, he didn't even feel like they were going full speed yet. And Gordon sailed in a corner and he tried to match him and just lost it. So there's, you know, it's one thing to try to follow somebody and learn. It's something else to know the limitations of your skills. And it's been a humbling experience for him. I think he feels like being in the 32, being in a full-time ride is a big change this year, and it's kind of changed his outlook and changed the way he's attacking racing. I think he's put in his time and learned a lot, and now he's kind of honing his craft a little bit. And, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing him, especially the second half of this year when we start going back to tracks. I think it's going to be really interesting to see what he does in that 32. Because I think he's got a good fan base. I think he's got a good support system. And just all in all, I think it's things are lining up well. And who knows? We may end up seeing him getting in an even better seat in another couple of years.
Yeah, and I'm sure he's got a lot to say about Talladega. So, Neff, let's go to my conversation with Corey LaJoy. All right, Corey, you tied a career-best 11th place finish on Sunday at Talladega. It might be a broad question, but take us through your weekend as a whole.
Well, there's a new package for everybody here, so we didn't really quite know what we had going in. And we just ran single-car runs because anytime we go to the super speedways, we're on ultra-conserve mode until, like, 3 laps to go in the race like you saw on Sunday, so... Mm-hmm. We only ran about 6 laps in practice, and then we made a single car run, which we weren't very good. We were, I think, 36th in qualifying, so we didn't have a blazing fast car by itself, but we were able to kind of maintain with the front pack there and bide our time through the first couple stages and miss a couple of the wrecks, but for the most part, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of wrecks, so we just rode, you know, in right around 19th to 21st all day and executed on pit road and did speed, and pit crew did a good job, and then we were able to get in position there with that last restart with those couple guys wrecking, and we started on the bottom, and we were able to push that line tight, and I wish we were able to come back around and race the checker, because I felt like we could have even ended up a little better than that, but 11th nonetheless, we'd be ecstatic with any other week of the year, so this was it was cool one to get.
Of course, and obviously you mentioned the new package with not having restrictor plates for the first time in I think 32 years at Talladega, so the speeds were up a little bit, but NASCAR implemented the 9-inch spoiler, obviously, which created, you know, it slowed the speeds down a little. How was that from the driver's seat?
You know, call it what you want, right? We're still restricting the airflow into the engine by just a different term of a spacer. Instead of a restrictor plate, it is a tapered spacer. But sounds better when you're reading it in a magazine. So we still are restricting a 900 horsepower engine down to a 550 horsepower engine every week. Until we can actually build 550 horsepower engines and not restrict them, I think is when some of the cost stuff's going to come back down to reality. That's a whole different can of worms we don't really want to open right now, though.
Yeah, let's not do that right now. But how were the cars to drive? Because, you know, I talked to Joey Logano a few weeks back, and he thought they're going to be, you know, very, with all the downforce, he thought they're going to be pretty easy to drive. But from my perspective,
I think it was the exact opposite of that.
Yeah, it looked very edgy, right?
Yeah, because I think the more downforce we kept putting on them, the bigger and bigger, the more turbulent the air got. So the further you get back in the pack, man, that thing was like tank flappers to lights. I mean, you were damn swatting flies in there even when you were just behind a single car, just going around, like you had to be on your toes because, you know, you were rolling out and you were trying to time the gas, and, you know, the guys from probably fourth on back in a row were having to drive pretty hard. The guys in the front might have had a little bit easier of a time because they had more downforce overall, but I think the biggest thing isn't so much downforce. I think if we're so stiff in the back with springs that you're not very linear or very compliant, and your rear grip is all or nothing, right? So as soon as somebody starts to, hitting you or bum drafting you, or you get out of shape and the bar wraps up, you go from having a 4,000-pound spring in the left rear to no weight pushing down on the tire because the car unloads off of it. So you get a lot of change in, you know, your dynamic wedge when turbulent air hits it or your bump draft. And back in the day when you could do tandem and you could move around a lot, you had a pair of 600s back there, so you had a lot of compliance and you had a lot of movement in the car up and down. Now you don't have any of that.
Yeah, it's pretty technical, but I mean, what tweaks can be made? Because obviously, you know, on the last lap, Kyle Larson had that little hit to the right rear, and as the car approached the inside wall, it got up in the air and then ultimately flipped by itself. So what tweaks can be made?
I mean, that's above my pay grade. There's lots of smart guys looking at CFD, I'm sure, evaluating that crash. But I didn't really study it. It almost, so I might be speaking out of turn here, but it looked like when he was sideways going at that 45-degree angle that his roof flaps didn't deploy. They might have. I don't know. But the one shot that I looked at real quick, it looked like the roof flaps didn't open up as quick as it normally does. But, you know, anytime those cars get sideways at 200 miles an hour, I feel like we've done a pretty good job. NASCAR's done a pretty good job overall to keep them on the ground. But every now and then you'll see one pack some air up underneath the car and over she goes. It might have had something to do with the wicker, too, that wasn't allowing the air to escape over the spoiler. I bet you that wicker had something to do with the pressure on the deck lid as well.
Yeah, that's what Neff thought, too. He thought, you know, he's pretty technical, so he thought that might have had something to do with that little wicker bell.
Neff, technical. That is funny. That is funny.
But Corey,
I've heard Neff called a lot of things. Technical is not one of them.
Hey, something new every day, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, from our perspective, it looked kind of like a throwback to the early 2000s, the way the race kind of played out. You know, when Dale Jr. was dominant, DEI was kind of taking over at the plates with Michael Waltrip as well. A ton of jockeying for position. Is that accurate or am I way off?
Say that again.
Yeah. You know, we're kind of around the same age, and you flash back to, like, early 2000s when Dale Jr. was dominating the plate races, and also Michael Waltrip, DEI, really. On Sunday, I thought that race looked a lot like the early
2000s. Well, back in the 2000s, I think the engine rules were a little bit more open than they were nowadays, to be honest with you. when an organization wins that many in a row, that dominant for 3 years in a row, they have a little bit something nobody else does. That's part of racing, and that's another story as well. But I don't know. I thought it was one of the better speedway packages we've had in a long time because there was a lot of runs, and I didn't think that the leader was as dominant and couldn't block the lanes as easily as in years past because you could formulate those runs and get going, and it was nice having some power to close gaps and to maybe formulate a run and go up the middle places where you wouldn't normally be able to go. But you know, Talladega is also a place where handling isn't as important as Daytona, where I think you might see a little bit different of a race play out Daytona, especially as evil as these cars handled last week. I think you're gonna see guys just kind of settle in and get single file. More, you always see that at Daytona more so than Talladega because, you know, Daytona is more of a handling track and it's hotter. So, I like this package more, but I think everybody is in agreement that Daytona we need to get a brunt of the laps knocked off and just kind of everybody's riding, you know, single file up against the fence. But I don't know, who knows? You know, everybody wants to run for stage points, and if you're like Ty Dillon, you celebrate like you won the Daytona 500 when you won the first race of the day. I don't really, granted, I've never won a stage, but I can promise you I won't be screaming like I just won the championship when I do. So, but that's different folks, strokes driven folks.
That's pretty funny. I mean, how aggressive was the racing? Because you look at, like, you know, early on Bubba Wallace. I know you're friends with him. And Neff and I were discussing, you know, that was probably a little too early to be racing like that, being aggressive. I think he started in the mid-20s. And he rocketed up towards the front early. But, was there too much aggression? And would that be too much aggression?
Well, I mean, who am I to say what his strategy was, right? He could have tried to go to drive to the lead and control the race. I don't know. But, obviously, being a Monday morning crew chief, I would probably say when he's picking spare parts out of the fence that he probably was a little bit too aggressive. But I think that it was a combination of Ryan throwing a block as well. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I didn't look at it closely, but it looked like Bubba was committed to – he was going to go to the bottom, mm-hmm. and at the same time, Ryan went to the bottom. I don't know if Ryan was blocking Bubba or they both simultaneously made a move to go to the lead. And then Bubba had to turn left more than he expected, so it unloaded the left rear. And then, like I said, that package, it just unloads, and then you start tank slapping, and you get behind on your steering, and all of a sudden you're in the fence.
Right. Now, later on in the race, you know, you mentioned avoiding the big crashes, and there weren't many of them, like you said. But you were right in the middle of the Chris Busch, Eric Almirola one. How were you able to get through that one?
Yeah, Matt DiVendetto. it was Buescher and DiVendetto who was wrecked.
Right. But, Almirola, he turned Buescher, though, which started it.
It's hard. Oh, that's right. So, I'll tell you, man, the wrecks in the corners aren't that bad because you can see it happening because the banking, right, and they're going around the radius of the corner, you can see the cars. The ones in the straightaway, in the backstretch in particular, are super hard to see because you can't see more than the spoiler right in front of you, right? Because there's no banking. Everybody's in the same plane. So all you see is smoke, mm-hmm. right? And then everybody scatter, and then usually there's a car stop right in front of you, and you just pray you don't hit it. And, you know, I just saw those guys spinning, and I saw the broad side of the 37. I'm like, oh, hell. I mean, I was on the binders as hard as I can be on the binders, and I locked the rear tires up, and I was like, okay, I got to get off the brake. I don't want to, like, Van Valero wreck this thing where you lock the rear brakes up and back into them. So I found myself, instead of, like, looking to where I needed to go and, like, to miss the wreck, I found myself looking at the 37, like, okay, don't hit them. And then the more I kept looking at them, the more my hands kept following them. So I had to, like, consciously, like, pull my eyes off that car to go where I needed to go. But then it felt like I was in Days of Thunder and the seas were parting, and I got on the radio. I said, the rule is you're supposed to aim right for him. Yeah, so I did that, pulled one out of Cole Trickle's handbook, and made it through.
Yeah, you made it through. That's all that matters, right?
Yep.
Now, I mean, this was a good finish, though, for you in Go Fast. Like you said earlier, you guys needed this. You had, what, 18th in the 500. But how important was it to get that good finish at Talladega, not just for you, but for the team, and kind of build some momentum going forward?
I mean, we've had a couple good runs the last weeks. We had a really good run going at Bristol. We should have finished probably 20th or 21st. Then we had a lower control arm break. So we would have had a 21st, 26th at Richmond, which I thought was a good day as well. And then 11th at Daytona or Talladega. So, you know, we've had a good couple stretch of races. You know, I don't really know. I kind of do know what to expect here at Dover, but I don't think it's going to be a particularly good race just because they punched such a big hole in the air and the tires are so hard and we don't have enough power to move up the racetrack. Mm-hmm. So I think it's going to be one groove, a lot of dirty air, and track position is going to be pretty big. So it's just going to be a matter of honestly how good your motor is and how much grip you got. And I wouldn't say that's one of our strong suits. You know, we have good power, but you know we're not on that A program, so we get beat a little bit there, and we get beat a little bit just in wind tunnel time that we don't have. So, you know, Dover is one of those tracks where if you're off a little bit, you're off a lot. But, you know, it's one of my better tracks statistically in anything but the Cup Series. So I finished sixth there in a Xfinity car and won a K&N race there. So I've run well, just not in a Cup car, because you got to have all your ducks in a row when you go to Dover for the old Monster Mile.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that K&N win. I think it was in 2012. How big was that for you, really getting on the radar in NASCAR?
Well, that was just a part of that year where, you know, that was that year overall was kind of the catapult of my career where, you know, we were contending for the championship with Kyle Larson and Bubba and Suarez and Chase Elliott and all those guys. And Ryan Blaney raced occasionally, you know. And I was right in the mix, and I was even, you know, the guy to beat most of the week. So that gave me confidence. Even it still gives. I can look back and draw some confidence to that one. You know, things aren't going good, you know, and I start to doubt myself a little bit, just for the sake of, you know, not being able to compete with those guys like I want to ultimately. But you know, I know deep down that, you know, that guy that was racing wheel to wheel, those guys are still in here and still capable of doing that. Just haven't been able to show the sport as a whole and the fans. You know, because all they see is, you know, on Sunday, and all the Corey LaJoie they've seen on Sunday hasn't been particularly exciting, just because you're at the mercy of whatever equipment you're sitting in. So, you know, once fans know, you know, that what I'm capable of, then I think that everybody be able to jump on board and really support me, because, you know, the fans. Is good of a personality, and you know, however nice of a guy I am, and right, how funny I can be. Like, people still like to root for winners at the end of the day. They're not going to root for the guy that runs 28th every week. So, trying to pair the competitive side on track to the marketable side off the track. And I think once we can do that, is when you'll really see some positive traction going.
Yeah, I think you summed that up pretty well, because from an outside perspective and knowing you, I think you're one of the more personable drivers in the whole. You know, in all of NASCAR. So you got that going for you. But overall, you know, we kind of hit on this earlier, but how would you say 2019's gone for you? Obviously, you've got, you know, a few good runs, like you said. And your goals, I mean, they've got to be different from, you know, the top teams, obviously.
Yeah, for sure. You know, if I were to give it a grade to date, I'd probably say a B, B plus. I've made some mistakes, and I think there's just some areas where the team's getting used to me, and I'm still getting used to the team. And, you know, there's things where I've felt like I've improved on as a driver, and they've improved on with a team with their average finishing being up, even though we've had a couple parts malfunctions and parts failures this year. You know, if we can rule those out, we'd be even better. So I think that overall, right now, we got some positive momentum. Me and Randy are communicating well, and they're starting to understand, you know, my driving style, how I need the cars to be set up, and me and David Pepper, the spotter, are starting to get on the same page as well. So we're starting to get the ball rolling. It's hard anytime you move teams. You know, it's hard for the teams that have been together for multiple years to be competitive each and every week, let alone, you know, swapping people and cars and manufacturers and you know, filling the blank. Crew chiefs every single year. It's just, I could not necessarily relearn everything, just get acclimated that much quicker.
For sure. And I'll end with this one with you, Corey. Single car qualifying, that's something you haven't done at the Cup level yet. What are your thoughts on that, coming back at, you know, all the tracks, what, over a mile? All ovals.
So, honestly, I kind of like it for the position we are here. Like, here's my thing, right? Like, anytime if we can get a draft or this or that, all we're doing is we've won positions where if we first, then we're going to be running 27th in three laps. Uh-huh. Like, we are a 27th to 31st place car on speed, and no matter if there's 40 cars in the racetrack or the because the last, like, I hate starting when, you know, when 10 cars fail tech, you start 18th, and the guys that are a second and a half faster than you blow your doors off and you're doing all you can not to wreck. I'd rather just start where speed-wise where we are and just race the racetrack and then, you know, take advantage of when those guys have issues or whatever. You know, there's you might be able to steal three or four spots in a 15-lap heat race at Stafford Motor Speedway. Mm-hmm. You're not stealing four or five spots at the beginning of a 500-mile race. Like, let's just single car qualifying. Hey, you stack up where you stack up. None of this grasping BS we got going on. Also, on the sponsor side, it gives the network, 50 seconds worth of time if they don't flip the commercial and Coral of the Joy goes out, which usually happens, to talk about whatever sponsor we have that week, because they don't ever talk about us on the race unless something bad happens, which is usually bad for everybody involved. So it's just a little extra TV time for sponsors and everybody involved.
Got it. Well, Corey, thanks for coming on. Good job this past weekend in Talladega, and we'll see you at the Monster Mile.
Sweet, thanks.
All right, y'all. There you have it. A fun conversation with Corey LaJoy, talking about his Talladega run, and where the 32 teams really at right now, and some of their goals moving forward. I know myself and Neff, you know, we definitely appreciate Corey's perspective, because let's be honest, he's an old school race car driver, one of the guys that worked on his own cars growing up while racing. And plus, it's his fifth time on the podcast, and we definitely appreciate his time. Before we get out of here, though, kind of a somber note, Neff noted to me that Legends car driver Silas Hiscock Sr. passed away at Riverhead Speedway on Saturday following a practice crash. Our thoughts and prayers are definitely with his family. But that does it for this week's podcast. Make sure to tune in for next week's show, where we review Dover. Until then, we out.